Welcome to The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter. We are committed to bringing you the day's most important news and current affairs stories from an LGBTI perspective. If it matters to the LGBTI community, we will cover it. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, SMS 0427 Joy 949 or email onair at joy.org.au or follow us on Twitter at The Informer Joy.
It's Tuesday the 31st of July. Welcome to the best of The Informer. This week we are showcasing the best journalism from your nightly news and current affairs show so far for 2018. I'm your host, Rachel Tyler-Jones. Tonight on the show, as part of our International Women's Day special, we ask the question, when should we start talking to young LGBTIQ women about the cost of fertility? When you are socially infertile, it can be pretty expensive to start a family, but many LGBTIQ women don't discover these costs until they're already ready to take that step, at which point it's too late to save. And we look at the harmful practice of gay conversion therapy. Chris and Robert each shared with us their experiences of gay conversion therapy, and we spoke with Senator Janet Rice about what we can do to not only regulate this so-called therapy, but stop it causing further harm to LGBT Australians around the nation.
This is The Informer on Joy 94.9.
The reality is that many LGBTIQ women face social infertility because starting a family comes at a literal financial cost. With women already in the lower financial bracket in the workplace, the cost of starting a family for women in our communities can be a big shock. So, when do we start talking to young LGBTIQ women about preparing for a career and the costs of starting a family? Dean Arcuri spoke to lesbian mother Fiona Newton about what it was like planning to be a mother when you were accessing fertility treatments.
It's funny, you don't really have an understanding of what the cost is going to be up front, I think, because it depends how many times you have to try, you know, do the insemination and go through the IVF cycle. There's lots of kind of expenses that only become apparent as you go along, and it was a bit more expensive than what we thought. It's a little bit of a funny process in that Medicare does give you rebates for some of it, but not all of it. So it's really important to understand what you can get Medicare from. And one of the things that I think is a little bit discriminatory against particularly lesbian couples wanting to go through the IVF cycle is that you have to go through two cycles of what they call insemination, which is essentially turkey basting that the doctor does, whether you like it or not. We wouldn't have chosen to do it, but it costs $5,000 to do that. And then if you do that, you're deemed, and it doesn't work, that's when you can be deemed infertile. There's a little bit more to it. You basically have to go on hormones before that, and then time your cycle appropriately, and then it's kind of done at the right time, I suppose, and with the right hormone levels in your body. So it's a little bit more science than just here's a Vegemite jar and good luck. but it's a bit annoying that we have to go through a process to prove ourselves to be infertile, yet we're a lesbian couple that is already, you know, socially infertile. So why do we have to go through that process, and why do we have to pay that money? And if you don't pay that money and then are deemed infertile, then you have to go without Medicare payments. So it's a little bit, can be damned if you do, damned if you don't.
It's a fact that motherhood has to be very, very planned for most female-bodied, same-sex attracted people. And when other means come into play to make a family, it's a potentially expensive and difficult thing to go through. Women are already at a disadvantage socially and financially within workplaces. And as an LGBTIQ woman, career planning plus family planning has mounting costs that you may not expect. Should we be teaching all young LGBTIQ women to save for family planning early? Because if you can't get knocked up by accident, it can be very freaking expensive. I spoke to Anne from Rainbow Fertility, who's a fertility specialist and gynecologist, about what kind of base costs you can expect if you have a working uterus.
If someone has uterus tubes and ovaries and wants to get pregnant, then the options, and everyone has choice. That's sometimes difficult if you have to make a choice, isn't it? But yeah, everyone has choice. So usually the younger a woman is, the more we're considering or suggesting more natural or less invasive methods, because, you know, really that would be best to do first if, you know, time allowed. So For example, if a woman is, 35 and is wanting to get pregnant and appears, the system, reproductive system is functioning, then usually we're talking about insemination rather than jumping straight to IVF. Of course, some people want to choose to do IVF, and a lesbian couple may want to do reciprocal or interpartner IVF, where one does the stimulation to get the eggs, using a sperm donor to fertilise, create embryos, and then the other partner actually carries their child. So that would mean having to do IVF. So all of these different choices have costs. So the simplest cost and choice is insemination, and the out-of-pocket cost for doing a cycle is around $2,500 to $3,000. So it's a very expensive option, but it is actually cheaper than doing IVF. Because of this cost, some people do home insemination. We know this happens, of course. Their own choice of donor. If people choose to do this, it's obviously free, but people should be aware of, and that is obviously there is a small chance of contracting viruses or bacteria from sperm, and to try as much as possible to reduce their chance by having their donor screened regularly. And I think not choosing someone who you think might be at risk as well is the other thing. So the cost of doing home insemination is free. The cost of doing clinic insemination is around $2,500 to $3,000 out of pocket. The cost of doing IVF, if Medicare cannot be accessed, is around $10,000 to $11,000. If Medicare can be accessed, it's around $5,000 to $6,000. So it's all extremely expensive, I suppose, is the bottom line.
But that's if you have a working uterus. What if there are complications?
The whole plan, of course, is to get a baby as quickly as possible. It's, simplest, safest and cheapest. But, say someone has symptoms suggestive of endometriosis, or they've had an ultrasound that suggests they have endometriosis, then we may well be looking at talking about treating that first, like surgery. So, it does depend on what their history is. And if someone has an issue of, pelvic operations or any idea that they may have some issues with tubes, then we assess that first. We look at finding out if they truly do have, problems with the tubes, and that may be by tubal function test, which is an outpatient procedure, which is, uncomfortable. It's not a little bit painful, where dye is pushed through the uterus and tubes to see if there's any blockages. Or it can be done asleep, which is still an operation, which is a laparoscopy to assess tubal function. So, it depends what looks like or appears that might be a heads up that there could be a gynae issue before we start a treatment, because we're obviously wanting to maximise the chance of any treatment working.
The average age of first-time mothers across Australia is 30 years old, a number that's continuing to increase year after year. But this isn't something that they're seeing with first-time mothers at Rainbow Fertility.
The average age of lesbian women accessing fertility treatment is, in my practice, is younger than heterosexual couples. And the reasons for that I don't know, but I'm guessing maybe that heterosexual couples think, okay, well, we've got time, we can try when we like later on. Whereas it's obvious for lesbian women, if they need sperm, that maybe they need to consider accessing a fertility service sooner rather than later, because it's something they have on their on the table if they're wanting to have a child, that they need time and information about what they need to do and when they want to do it. And maybe that's a good thing, that people aren't leaving it longer, because female age is always the best indicator for fertility success, meaning the younger a woman is, the more likely it is to be successful.
So when is the right time for us to be talking to LGBTIQ women about family planning so that they can start planning for the costs involved?
I think the answer is always that whenever anyone's ready. So ideally in their 20s, which I know sounds young, fertility is best when a woman is aged, from 20 to 30, really. So in your 20s, if possible. But we'll see anyone of any age, of course. But, it's something to think about when you're young.
I asked how prepared people were when they hear about the cost of fertility treatments.
Because I think they've already done homework before they come and see me. So when I say, oh, look, it's going to be a shock, it's going to be very expensive, this is how much it is, they don't say, I'm surprised. They say, oh, yeah, that's what I thought. So I'm not certain if that means, but you'd think it probably did, but there's a lot of people out there who are all wanting to access the service that, you know, it's outside their budget, their current budget. So, yeah, I think that's probably where it stands. But people, as they come in, they've already done their homework and worked and called clinic and found out how much it's going to cost them.
So what about DIYing with a turkey baster? While not a course of action that is discouraged, Anne reminds us that you still need to make sure you're looking after yourself and your family in the best possible way.
I mean, I know that it has many advantages to do home insemination, but there are medical disadvantages of the risk in using fresh sperm. And it may not be a fertility specialist. It might be their GP, you know, that their family doctor that can do their, you know, testing of their donor. So, which should also, of course, include a sperm test to check there's, you know, good sperm there, that they're not spending months and months, you know, trying something that's very unlikely to work.
The reality is that many LGBTIQ women suffer from social infertility, and making a family can be a costly endeavour that's ultimately worth it, but expensive. We need to make sure we're letting our younger generations know the realities and the costs of the life that they want to have, so they can start planning to build the best future for themselves and their families.
I believe that everyone should have a right to have a child, and we try to find a treatment that suits them. Yes, it is very medicalised, but it's not like, it's not an intimate process that they can do at home with home insemination. So it has those disadvantages, but we try and be as respectful and helpful as we can be in a very medicalised setting. But that's for every patient, of course, not just same-sex attracted couples. So, yeah, but for everyone, I think that we know what we can offer, and we hope that we are meeting people's needs.
That was Dean Arcuri reporting with Anne from Rainbow Fertility.
This is The Informer on Joy 94.9.
Gay conversion therapy still happens in Australia. But what does gay conversion therapy actually mean? It isn't as overt as you might think. We hear from Chris and Robert as they share their past experience trying to rid themselves of their homosexuality through this so-called therapy.
My experience with gay conversion ideology started when I was really, really young, growing up in church. And I was hearing all sorts of things about gay people, that they were abominations, that they are sick, that they are sinful, that they've made choices to be gay, even that they were demon-possessed. And I guess, even though I was a child, when I heard those things in church, and sometimes they were, you know, it was overt messaging, sometimes it was really subtle, but when I heard those things, I really took them to be about me. Particularly when I was about 10, I realised that I might be gay when I was about 10 or 11. And so those things that I'd heard in church and that messaging around homosexuality being something that's wrong with you became part of my identity, and it became part of how I saw myself. And so I saw myself as sick. I saw myself as perverted and as an abomination, as someone who just was not okay being who they are.
You know, I came out only about 4 and a bit years ago, and I'm in my mid-50s now. So I've hidden my sexuality for most of my life, even though I knew about it. 10 years ago, I was married, and the horror, being a Christian, and I was evangelical fundamentalist Christian, so at one point I was state director for the Australian Christian Lobby. For 5 years, I was president of the Christian school in Mombulk. And it was a horror to think that I was gay, because the Christian community is so against gay people. So I thought, well, I need to do something about this. I need to fix it. So I sought out help from my GP and my counsellor at the time, because I was having therapy for depression, because I was severely depressed. And he said, well, you know, you're gay. We don't fix that. That's normal. I wouldn't listen. I was so convinced that, you know, there must be something in my past that had caused me to be like that. I bought into the idea that it was my mum or my dad that had caused me to be like this. I then went to the church, and I spoke to one of the pastors at City Life at the time, where I was going, in Monturner. And he said, oh, yes, we can help you with that.
You know, even when I was 11, I thought that I may have demons in me. And so when I came out at 16 and I spoke to my pastor about my concerns and my worries about being gay, and he suggested that there was a way that I could be healed from it, I jumped at it because I was desperate. I was really scared. I spent so many years as a kid really frightened to death of hell. I really believed that that was where I was going, and it was scary.
For about 6 months, I'd go every once or twice a week, and I would have this gay conversion therapy where they tried to... It was very painful. Every night I would go, I would burst into tears at some point, you know, more than once sometimes. I had to do all sorts of things, like I had to wear an elastic band and flick it every time I had sexual thoughts, which, of course, is every night. And if I get an erection at night and have sexual thoughts, I had to have a cold shower, which I did. Hands up, I did it all, because I thought that's what you had to do, because I didn't know any better.
When my pastor at the time told me that God could heal me and that there was organisations out there that helped people to change, I was really excited about it. I was really relieved, because up until then, I was really worried that I was always going to be that way and that it was going to be something that would ruin my life. So it was a 9-month course, and there are so many different there were so many different courses available at that time, and they all had different ways of running. The one that I went to was a 9-month course. We'd meet every week, and it ran a lot like Alcoholics Anonymous, like that style of support group, I suppose you'd call it. We purchased these really thick textbooks. It was a manual to the course that was full of, you know, it talked about sort of pseudo-psychological reasons for being gay, and talked about how broken sexuality could be healed. So we would sit in a sermon about the chapter that we'd read that week. We'd have homework to do. We'd have to answer questions in the book. We'd have a time of worship. And then we'd all split off into small groups. And they'd split us into boy and girl groups. And we would confess our sins to each other. And we would talk about the struggles that we'd had that week with our sexuality. And then we would be anointed with oil. So it was really a lot like a support group AA style of ministry. I think the damage that came from it was that it confirmed and really hammered home all of that messaging from when I was a kid, that I'm broken, that I'm not okay the way I am, that who I am is not okay with God, that homosexuality is an abomination. All of that stuff really got hammered home. And I, when I left, of course, I was still gay. I was probably gayer than when I started. But, yeah, when I left, I was, I mean, not only disappointed because I'd really sort of been sold this idea that it was the answer, and here I was still gay. I was even more convinced that I was broken.
After I'd done the gay conversion therapy, I went on this manliness course, and there was this most gorgeous, and I won't describe him in detail in case he listens to this by any chance, because I don't want him to know that I fell in love with him. And he never knew, because he was just the most gorgeous-looking person. He got the most wonderful personality. He just pressed all my buttons at once. And I thought, shit. I can't do this. I can't, you know, I'm still gay.
Basically, after that, I really desperately went about trying anything and everything that I could possibly find to try and change. So I went to exorcisms. I was reading books. I was going to other ex-gay ministries, different prayer nights and conferences and all sorts of things. So really desperately trying anything that I could to give it over to God and find some kind of healing. Obviously, none of it worked.
We've moved down to Narre Warren just recently, and I thought, well, time I ought to see if I could find a local church that was welcoming. So I've started to scan around and trying to find it. Of course, they all aren't. And one church in particular, I got very irritated with them because they wouldn't tell me what their position was. So I did some secret shopping, and they offered me gay conversion therapy there and then. So it's still going on, and it's still rife in the church. The attitude is that you choose to be gay, and that because you've made a choice, you can make an unchoice. You can choose not to be gay. But, of course, none of them would try and choose to be gay to prove the point.
The way that it was presented to me was as an ex-gay ministry. It was an answer to a problem. You know, it's funny, you know, the church taught me that I was broken, and then, you know, lo and behold, the church has this way to fix it.
I don't think that the church will be won over by theological arguments. I think the church will be won over by them seeing gay people and understanding that we are not a threat. And I think this is a culture clash that has come out about over the last 50 years since the gay community has become more visible. It was possible 50 years ago to say, well, there aren't any gay people because you never saw them.
It's not something that's openly talked about anymore. I mean, years ago, ex-gay ministries used to visit churches and do information evenings, but they don't do that now. It's very much underground now. I think probably public backlash and a change in public opinion around homosexuality and the way that we treat people based on their sexuality has changed a lot in the last 10, 15 years. And so I think most ministries that peddle this ideology that being gay is broken aren't able or aren't comfortable to really publicly say what their intentions are.
This is The Informer on Joy 94.9.
I want to thank Robert and Chris for sharing their stories with us on The Informer. Dino Curie and Thomas Morgan sat down with Senator Janet Rice to discuss how parliamentarians can legislate against a practice that, in Australia, is happening within religious organisations around the country.
To think that it was still going on in Australia in 2018 is just appalling, and that there are still, you know, young gay people who are being really traumatically disturbed by their churches.
How is that something on a political level that we can combat?
I think that's a really good question, and it's just, you know, what does it mean? What can you outlaw? And I know the Victorian and the Queensland governments have been grappling with this. And so in Victoria, you know, the Health Services Commission is tackling it through its being fraudulent practices. So at its core, if you've got this, you know, so-called therapy that is clearly not successful, is not based on any success rates, any logic, any science at all, but they are presenting it as being something that's going to be successful to sort of cure people of homosexuality, clearly it's fraudulent. But it is, I mean, I think it is, it's part of this, it's cultural change that we need, but the churches that are still putting young people through this need to be told that it's just not on, that it's unacceptable to be putting people through this psychological torture. And to do that, there need to be some sanctions. They need to know that if they are doing that, that there are going to be something that happens because of that. So what we're calling on at a federal level is that the federal government need to show some leadership, and at a federal level to really bring together the states, bring together people who have experienced gay conversion therapy, bring together the various state legal bodies to work through what's the best way of tackling this at a national level, and in particular, what's the best way of tackling it so it just doesn't get driven more and more underground. Because that's what I think has, you know, what's so surprising and what's really worrying that's come out in the last year is the fact that people thought it had gone away, but no, it's just been driven underground.
All of these issues were always seen as very black and white.
It's a culture
us versus
wars.
Religion, yeah. One versus the other. You know, it must be this or that. But when we speak about conversion therapy, there are so many layers in regards to what it actually is, how it's actually happening, and the way in which people are dealing with the repercussions of going through it. How do you think we can combat that in a public conversation? Because you're having these conversations on air with us now, also, you know, in Parliament. How can we combat that space of religion bad, everything else this?
I think there's a role for religious organisations that don't support the views of the ACL to speak out and to say that they accept people who are LGBTI and they accept them in their church and they accept them for who they are. And increasingly we know that's the case. And we know that the majority of people who have a religious faith in Australia, for example, supported marriage equality last year. And so I'm sure an even greater majority of people of a religious faith in Australia accept LGBTI people for who they are. They accept their sexuality. And they also would understand that it is just futile and damaging to people to try and change their sexuality. It just doesn't work. So I think we're on this journey of cultural change in our country, and we need to continue on and make it a bit faster, I think, so that the people like those who are still proposing this so-called therapy, and people like the ACL are very much seen as just a tiny, tiny, hurtful, hateful minority who don't then have any broad support, even within religious organisations. And so that they will realise that they are out of step, even with the people that they are proposing and purporting to represent. But, you know, that's the journey that we're on of this cultural change. And, you know, we have come a long way. If you think about where we've come in over the last 30 or 40 years, but we've still got a long way to go, and we just need to keep on keeping on.
Full interviews with both Robert and Chris, as well as the full interview with Senator Janet Rice, are available to download via the JOY website at joy.org.au/theinformer. Gay conversion therapy causes depression, anxiety, self-loathing, and, in some instances, drives individuals to self-harm. If you are aware of any organisations or individuals practising in conversion therapy, I encourage you to notify the Australian Health Practitioner Regulatory Agency at ahpra.gov.au, or you can call them on 1300 419 495.
This is The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter.
That's it for tonight's episode of The Best of The Informer, bringing you news and current affairs for Australia's LGBTI communities. Don't forget to follow us on social media at The Informer on Joy 94.9 on Facebook and at The Informer Joy on Twitter. You've been listening to The Informer on Joy 94.9. I'm Rachel Tyler-Jones.